Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does a society move past the horrors of genocide when the forces responsible for violence continue to hold power and to justify and even celebrate human suffering on a massive scale? When filmmaker Joshua Oppenheimer asked ordinary Indonesians about their memories of the 1965 communist purge that left as many as a million dead within a year, he found survivors deeply reluctant to share their stories, afraid even now of recriminations. But when he tracked down some of the most notorious killers, they were only too happy to relive their memories and even recreate them on film. He captures those staged scenes and the making of them in his critically acclaimed new documentary, The Act of Killing, which opens tomorrow at the Angelica Film Centers in Plano and Dallas. Joshua Oppenheimer, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much.
So before the shock of the film itself even sets in, there is the startling revelation, I think, to many Americans that there was a genocide on this scale in the mid-60s in Indonesia, supported in part by Western governments. Can you give us a little background?
Yeah, in 1965, the left-leaning, non-aligned, that is, it was neither aligned with the Soviet Union nor with the United States in the Cold War, the non-aligned government of Sukarno, he was the founding father of modern Indonesia and the first president of Indonesia after the Dutch colonial rule ended in 1945, his government was overthrown in a right-wing military coup in which the military enlisted civilian death squads, trained and then recruited civilian death squads to help them kill anywhere between 500,000 and 2.5 million opponents of the new military dictatorship within anywhere between 6 months and a year. And the killings, the targets of the killings included not just they included trade unionists, they included women's rights advocates, they included teachers, artists, intellectuals, the ethnic Chinese, and members of Indonesia's left-wing parties, including the Communist Party. They were all, with a broad brush, accused of being communists and were then, on that basis, put in concentration camps and then dispatched out to be killed in a very short time.
So you knew that this was a story you wanted to tell. What made it so challenging to try to simply document the stories of victims and survivors of that genocide?
Well, two things. First of all, when I would film with the, I began making The Act of Killing in collaboration with a community of survivors, and it wasn't that they were reluctant to tell what happened. It was rather that every time we would film together, as soon as word got out that we were in fact looking at what happened in the 60s, the army would come and stop us. The army is deployed all over the country. It's not just on big bases in, located in specific spots. It's everywhere. There's army in every village. And the army would come and stop us. They would detain us. They would take our equipment. They would take our tapes. And it became very difficult to film anything. So that was one thing, that the survivors were terrorized into silence, simply were not allowed to talk about what had happened to them. And the other thing was that the survivors would send me on these painful missions to speak with perpetrators who they knew, who were living in the same village and whom the survivors knew had been involved with the killings, in the hope that in speaking to the perpetrators, we might find out what had happened to their loved ones. See, all the survivors really knew was that their relatives had been taken away, put in camps, and then never returned.
Because if you were taken away, there was no chance that you were getting out again.
Well, some people did get out, but people who were killed, which was a very, very large number, there was no information that they'd been killed. They were, the vast majority of them were killed and dumped in rivers and allowed to drift out to the sea. So there was never, the death of people's loved ones was never confirmed. So people felt that meant survivors, even today, some survivors feel guilty even mourning for their loved ones because they don't actually have evidence or proof that their loved ones died. So we would be sent on these painful missions to try and find out from neighbors who were perpetrators in a plantation village about 60 miles from the city of Medan, North Sumatra, where we made the act of killing. We would be sent on these painful missions to go meet neighbors to see if we could find anything out about what had happened and about how people's relatives had died. And we would approach people at first cautiously, hoping they would be interested and curious about why there was a foreigner living in a totally untouristed plantation village in the middle of North Sumatra. We would approach cautiously ask questions about, people would invite us in curious, they would offer us tea, and they were old, so we would ask questions hoping to get into their past, questions like, what did you do for a living?
Mm-hmm.
And in response to such simple general questions, almost always we would be met with these grotesque, shocking, horrific, and boastfully told stories of killing. Because the killings, it turned out, had been, one, the most important thing that these perpetrators had ever done in their lives, and two, the basis for any career they had subsequently. So it felt at that time as though we found ourselves in the equivalent of Germany 40 years after the Holocaust, only to find that the Nazis were still in power.
Mm.
And there was a sense that it wasn't so much that we couldn't, that it wasn't worth making a film, or wasn't a good idea to make a film with the survivors. We were unable to do so at that point because the army basically wouldn't let us. But also another set of questions started to emerge, which was not about what happened in 1965 historically, but rather what is happening today in today's Indonesia, 40 years on, 45 years on, that these men are boasting. Why are they so open? What's the function of their boasting? For whom are they boasting? They would tell these awful stories in front of their grandchildren. Well, how do they want their grandchildren to remember them when they die? How do they want the world to see them? And how ultimately do they see themselves? These are questions about what happens to our normality when we build it on the basis of terror, lies, and mass graves. And so the film, The Act of Killing, is an effort to understand that. It's not really a film about, a historical film about the 1965 genocide. It's a film about the legacy of the past in the present.
You know, what struck me so much, Joshua, watching the film was that looking at these killers sort of being allowed to tell their own stories and being more than willing to do so, is that it almost seems like you're looking at a planet like Earth somewhere else where everything's upside down and the values are different. But this is, you know, an existing society that continues to this day.
Well, worse than that, you know, I began this journey the way I first came to Indonesia was I was asked to make a film about, with Christine Sin, about the struggle of oil palm plantation workers to organize a union in a Belgian-owned oil palm plantation 60 miles from Medan. And it turned out that they desperately needed a union because the women on that plantation, the women workers, women in their 20s and 30s, had to spray a herbicide at work that was without any masks or protection, and the herbicide was dissolving their livers and killing some of them in their 40s, early 40s. And so they desperately needed some way to demand that they be given protective clothing so they didn't have to kill themselves at work. And it turned out the biggest obstacle they had in organizing a union and making demands of their boss was fear. Fear because their parents and grandparents had been in a union and simply by virtue of being in a union had been accused in 1965 of being communist sympathizers, had been thrown in concentration camps by the army and then dispatched out to be killed, even though none of them really had anything to do with the Communist Party as such. And when I came to this horrific situation, as I said, it was like coming to Germany with the Nazis still in power 40 years on, or as you put it, this kind of upside-down alternative moral universe where black is white and white is black. From the outset, because I approach this through the stories of people who make our palm oil for us, who make the palm oil that's in our margarine, our skin cream, our soap, from the outset I recognize that this horrific immoral reality is not some distant reality on the other side of the globe, which is interesting as a sort of case study of the depths of human depravity or what would have happened if the Nazis had won, but rather it is the underbelly of our reality in the sense that everything we buy is made by people who are living in places where there's been mass violence, where perpetrators have won, where in their victory they have built regimes of fear so oppressive that they are unable to get the human costs of what we buy incorporated in the price tag that we pay. And all that makes Indonesia a little bit special is the shamelessness in the way the perpetrators speak. But, you know, when I arrived in the States from my home in Denmark for the release of the film here, it's much hotter here than it is in Denmark. I had to buy a T-shirt. I went to H&M, picked up a $6 T-shirt. As I snipped the label off, it says, Made in Bangladesh. And I'm forced to ask in that moment, I wonder if the people who made this T-shirt for me are now buried in a pile of rubble because their sweatshop collapsed in Bangladesh. Mm-hmm. So we all depend on the reality we see in the act of killing for our everyday living. We are all, this is a part of us. This is a part of who we are. And it's not simply something on the other side of the world.
So ultimately, Joshua, I think many people would agree that this idea to take people who were unabashed about the acts they had committed and invite them with the help of a professional film crew to reenact these things, I mean, it results in a really brilliant work. But of course, it could have been a disaster. Can you talk about the sort of questions you asked yourself when this idea occurred to you and the mental exercises you went through trying to figure out what all the possible conclusions that might come from this?
Yes. We made this film very much in collaboration with and in dialogue with the Indonesian human rights community and this community of survivors who, when we were not allowed to film with them, said, you must continue. We need a film here in Indonesia that exposes the nature of this regime, not so much for outsiders, for people living in the United States or elsewhere, but for Indonesians themselves. We need a film that holds a dark mirror up to our society so that we can recognize ourselves in it. We need a film that comes to Indonesia like the child in the emperor's new clothes and points at the king and says, look, the king is naked. Everybody knew it but had been too afraid to say it. Mm. We need a film that makes it possible for ordinary Indonesians to finally speak about issues and problems that they have been too afraid to address until now, and that pertain above all to contemporary Indonesia. So that was our number one moral and political commitment as we made this film. There was never a sense that we're making a film for the perpetrators, and the perpetrators' scenes, these dramatizations, they never have any life outside of the act of killing, and everybody, including the perpetrators, knew that from the very beginning. One of the consequences of this was that I was never interested in leading a main character to a place of remorse. The mm-hmm. film is, in that sense, not a psychodrama at all. Now, it does, through the process of making the reenactments and going through this filmmaking process, the main character in the film does come face to face with the reality of what he has done and is forced to sort of gaze into the abyss of what he's done, and he is ravaged by that, and the film shows that. But that's all, in a way, a part of this exposé, in the sense that it shows that even the men who, if they were genuinely the heroes they claim to be and ought to be, and they ought to be enjoying the fruits of their heroic victory in their old age, are in fact destroyed by what they've done.
My guest is filmmaker Joshua Oppenheimer. His documentary, The Act of Killing, opens tomorrow at the Angelica Film Centers in Plano and Dallas. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. And if you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is filmmaker Joshua Oppenheimer. He directed the documentary The Act of Killing, which opens tomorrow at the Angelica Film Centers in Plano and Dallas. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Joshua, you mentioned the character who is at the center of this film, a man named Anwar Kongo, who believes himself to have been directly involved in the deaths of at least 1,000 people. How did you sort of decide to place him at the center of the action, and what did you imagine might come from the time you spent with him?
Anwar was the 41st perpetrator I filmed. Once the survivors had started filming the perpetrators, I filmed every perpetrator I could find across the North Sumatran plantation belt. All of them were boastful. All of them would offer to take me to the places where they killed, demonstrate how they killed. And I worked my way across the region, up the chain of command from the countryside to the city. And in Medan, the largest city in North Sumatra, a city about the size of Chicago, perhaps, in Medan, it turned out that the army had recruited its killers from the ranks of movie theater gangsters. That's what they called themselves. They were gangsters involved with all sorts of organized crime, and yet they hung out in cinemas and, as a small side source of income, sold movie theater tickets on the black market and loved American movies. So Anwar was one of these men. As I said, he was the 41st perpetrator I filmed, and there was a way in which somehow I lingered on him because his pain was close to the surface. He was more boastful, more strident in his celebration of what he'd done than any of the other perpetrators I'd filmed, and yet he was also shadowed by a kind of trauma or remorse. And I think that sort of paradox, that he was at once seemed pained by what he had done but also was more celebratory about it than anyone else, kind of gave insight into something about the nature of impunity and the nature of the perpetrator's boasting, namely that it was not necessarily a sign of the lack of remorse, but rather its opposite. It was a sign, perhaps, that they're desperately trying to convince themselves that what they did was right. And that plot, combined with his love of American movies, set off this process where, when I screened the reenactments, the first reenactment back to him, he started to propose these embellishments, these surreal embellishments, where he thought he could fix what was wrong with the reenactment, namely that he felt bad seeing what he had done. He thought he could somehow fix that by embellishing it, by changing his costume, by dyeing his hair black so he would resemble his younger self, by improving his acting, and by starting to stage what he had done in the styles of his favorite movies. So in that sense, because everyone was reenacting what they had done and taking me to the places where they killed and showing me how they did it, the method of the film was not some kind of elaborate lure to get Anwar to open up. It was rather a response to their openness, an effort to understand the nature of their openness.
It is surprising, given his perspective on the savage acts that he committed, that he also admits rather openly to having his sleep is plagued by nightmares and has been for decades.
Well, I think at first it's surprising, but I think, in fact, the reason that he acts so positively about what he did is because he's desperately trying to avoid admitting that what he did was wrong. You see, normally when we see perpetrators in films, they've already been removed from power, and therefore they deny what they've done or else they apologize for it. But these men have been in power ever since the killings, and therefore they've never been forced to admit what they've done was wrong. And as Adi, one of the other killers in the film, says, killing is the worst thing you can do, but if you get away with it and you're paid well enough, go ahead and do it, but then you must make up an excuse so that you can live with yourself afterwards. And this is actually a fairly universal human thing. This is about lying to yourself. He's saying you must lie to yourself about what you've done so you can live with your actions. And he's saying it rather cynically, because he's saying, of course, it's wrong from the outset. So in that sense, in Anwar, I think I was able to see, yes, he's haunted by it. Yes, he has nightmares. He says it from the beginning, and he's celebrating it, not because he's immoral, not because he thinks it's right, not because he's proud of it, but because he's desperately trying to convince himself that it was right.
Some of these reenactments, Joshua, involve, you know, the burning of villages and the rape of women and girls, and the killing of unquestionably people who would have been perceived innocent in any kind of, you know, real legal situation. And you have to get like neighbors and people that are just from the surrounding area, including children, to go through this. And I was so struck by when we see children, but also adults going through these things, these are not professional actors. They're just regular people, but their terror feels very real to me.
I think there's two things there. First of all, early in the film, there's a scene where we see Anwar and his friends recruiting neighbors, women, children, to act in a massacre of a village. They're just walking down the street and collecting people, casting people in the middle of the road. It's a very surreal moment. And one of the things it shows, that scene, is that everybody in the society knows this story and lives with its consequences. Mm-hmm. They don't have to explain to the women and the children, you know, in 1965 this happened and we're reenacting it. Everyone knows. They're able to say, you play a communist, we come and burn down your house and you defend your house. And the scenario is familiar to everybody because it is the founding trauma of this regime. And so when the reenactments occur, real trauma does come to the surface. That said, in the actual event, when they actually reenact the massacre of the village, I removed everybody who was just a neighbor or somebody, just someone they collected on the street, and insisted that everybody who perform in that reenactment be the children or wives of the perpetrators or the paramilitary gangsters who support them, their proteges, as it were. There was nobody who's just a bystander in the actual scene. There's a woman after they attack this village. The village is, of course, a film set. After they attack the village, there's a woman who looks as though she's fainted, mm-hmm. and out of terror and trauma from the reenactment. Now, an Indonesian would see that she's not fainted, but she is possessed. They're trying to show that she's possessed, depending on whether or not we believe in possession. And there's two Indonesian young paramilitary members who are trying to do a kind of exorcism where they're trying to blow the ghost out of her. Now, she is old enough to remember those events and therefore may well have traumatic memories from the genocide. But she's the wife of a senior paramilitary leader who, on a TV chat show that was produced by Indonesian state television to celebrate the making of the film while we were making it. She's the wife of a man who goes on TV and says, God hates the communists, and that's why the film is coming out so wonderfully, and there will be no reconciliation because the history had to go this way. So everybody in the reenactment, is on the perpetrators, is from the perpetrators' families, and the children are immediately, you know, are acting with their parents and grandparents, and after each take, they were auditioned for their ability to cry, and after each take, they're comforted by their parents and grandparents. The takes are very brief; they're, you know, 1 or 2 minutes long.
I mean, does an 8-year-old have the ability to fully separate that this is pretend when watching a scene in which, you know, her mother or grandmother looks like she's about to be raped, her father or grandfather looks like he's about to be murdered? I mean, did you struggle with the psychic impact on children who may be related to, genocidal people but haven't done anything themselves?
Yeah, I intervened again and again to insist that the violence looks very, very fake. And we shot it. It doesn't look fake in the film. And that's because, but if you were to watch that sequence again in the film, the violence is shot through long lenses, through smoke, through fire, to obscure the sort of silliness of how it looked when you didn't see it through a camera. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is a society, the regime, the Indonesian government had produced very, 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 very graphic, brutal films justifying the genocide. One propaganda film in particular was 4.5 hours long, and every school child from the age of 6 onwards had to watch it every year, and it showed people getting their eyes gouged out and just really horrific things that children should not be watching. So it was really something, when we shot this scene, it was really important to me that, first of all, the takes be very brief, the violence look very silly and fake, and I think some of the children do cry. They were, as I said, they were auditioned for their ability to cry, but also they cry largely, I think, because the screaming is so loud. I don't think any of the children had a particular awareness about what the scene. I don't think any of them really understood what the scene is particularly about. And while you do, in fact, you don't see people, women who are about to be raped. You hear a man talk about how he would rape them. But in the actual violence, in the actual scene, you don't see that, because that wasn't one of the things that I allowed them to reenact.
So sometimes when you see a film, you know that you will remember a particular scene for forever. And for me, the scene in this film was when a neighbor of Anwar's, who has been sort of recruited to take part in one of these reenactments, begins to sort of offhandedly tell a story that initially sounds like it's just about someone he knows and then becomes very, very personal. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's it. That you were asking about the children, and I was saying quite honestly that I don't think the children went through anything, went through much of an ordeal making this film, and I was very aware of that throughout the process, aware of minimizing any ordeals that the children went through throughout the process. This is another matter. There's a neighbor of Anwar's named Suryono, whose stepfather was killed. He says that his stepfather was Chinese. In fact, it could have been his real father, and he's saying it's his stepfather so that they don't see him as Chinese, mm-hmm. and he doesn't have to face their anti-Chinese racism. But he was introduced to us as a great actor and a member of the paramilitary group. He was supposedly a great actor because he had been in a paramilitary theater troupe, which had existed until a couple years before I met Anwar and his friends and began shooting The Act of Killing. So I assumed that's what he was. He came in as both an actor and an assistant director to Anwar and his friends during some of the reenactments. And at one point, in the Indonesian state television soap opera studios in North Sumatra, where we were shooting some of the reenactments, he, at dinner, confides in Anwar and in Herman, one of the other main characters, that his stepfather was killed and could have been killed by men like Anwar. And he tells this story all the while smiling and trying to reassure them that he doesn't mean to criticize either what they've done or the film itself. And it's a very painful scene to watch. And then after that, they cast him to play the victim in the reenactment of torture, and he does. And while he is undoubtedly acting in the sense that he's speaking fictional lines, he breaks down in a very moving, painful way, and it's clear somehow that he's drawing on real trauma in that moment, that real trauma is coming up. In fact, he says at the end of his story, well, if you don't want to use my story in the film, at least this story can motivate the acting. And it certainly motivates his acting in this reenactment. Now, this is a scene that, for me, if there's an error in the film, if there's a mistake, it's this. It's an error of omission, not of commission, but it is an error. I am not a filmmaker who will stop at nothing to get what I want or to get the most powerful possible scene. When we were shooting in the sound studio, we would typically shoot with four or five cameras, and I was shooting something with another Death Squad member, Adi, in another part of the studio at the time when Suryono, the neighbor, told his story of how his stepfather was killed. And I wasn't filming that. My cinematographer was. My cinematographer is Colombian, does not speak Indonesian, did not understand the story. And we came home. After 4 months of shooting, I came home with this. You know, we were shooting 25 hours of footage a day, so we weren't able to watch all of it at all. And when we came home from the shoot, I came home with 560 hours of material from that one shoot. I, of course, went to the important scenes first, the big reenactments, the scenes with Anwar and the other actual killers, and edited those first. And then only a long time afterwards, months later, did I go through the side conversations that I had, with peripheral characters on the set to see if I missed anything. And lo and behold, I came across this story where a man, a member of the paramilitary group, reveals that, in fact, he's a victim. And I was mortified. I thought to myself, if I had heard this, I absolutely would have pulled him out. I would have taken him aside and said, stay with me behind the camera for the rest of the day, and tomorrow say, you have a cold and do not come back. You should not be here. Well, 2.5 years later, we finally had a rough cut of this film. There was 1,200 hours of footage in all, and there was two more big shoots after that. And so it was a long time later before we had a rough cut. And I noticed I felt it was very important to show what they did with this, with Suryono, with this man, after he told his story. So I called, but I was curious. I became more and more curious as to why he was there, because he kept cropping up in reenactment after reenactment after reenactment. So I phoned him, and his wife answered the phone and told me that he actually had passed away 6 months before I called, as from complications of diabetes. I asked why he was there. Did he ever talk about it? She said yes. He wondered when the film was coming out before he got sick, but also he had said that he had made this, been in your film because he really wanted to express the horror of what he'd been through as a child and understood that your film would be the right space for him to do this. And in that sense, he wanted to be there. He was on a mission that he succeeded at, and I'm glad he did. It certainly made the film more powerful for it. But at the same time, if I could do it all over again, and if I had heard that story, I would still remove him. I would not allow him to remain in the production, because there should not be a survivor participating in these reenactments.
My guest is filmmaker Joshua Oppenheimer. He directed the documentary The Act of Killing. The film opens tomorrow at the Angelica Film Centers in Plano and Dallas. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Joshua Oppenheimer, the filmmaker who directed the new documentary, The Act of Killing. The film opens tomorrow at the Angelica Film Centers in Plano and Dallas. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Joshua, something that comes up over and over in this film is that these self-described gangsters tell you a number of times that the word gangster comes from a phrase that means free men. And I've never heard that before, and I wonder where they got that idea.
Yeah, they get the idea because in Indonesian it's actually true. The Indonesian word for thug or gangster is preman, which comes from the Dutch word freeman, because the Dutch used thugs to do their dirty work, much as the regime in Indonesia has done since 1965. And they recruited their thugs from a kind of strata in society, a strata of drifters, a strata of men without normal social and family ties. And they euphemized that with the word free men. Mm. And this sort of etymological historical accident has been used to euphemize and to validate the existence of this whole parallel power structure of criminals who do the dirty work for the state and for large corporations.
So another really fascinating character here is that of Hermann Cotto that you alluded to earlier. He seems to be sort of a sycophantic figure, and in some ways his presentation of himself is so bizarre that he's almost a comic figure, and yet we don't feel comfortable laughing at him because of what he represents.
Yeah, I think Hermann is a comic figure, actually. And he is Anwar's protege. He represents the next generation of paramilitary leadership. He was not involved with the killings in 1965. He was too young. But he's a member of this vast paramilitary movement that continues to exist, Panchasila Youth, and of which Anwar and his friends were founding fathers. Now, Anwar dresses Hermann up and sort of picks on Hermann throughout the whole film. In fact, Anwar dresses Hermann in drag because Hermann had been in the same Panchasila Youth paramilitary theater troupe before I started making this film. And all the actors in this theater troupe were men, and the women's roles were played by men as well. And Hermann would play this kind of matronly storyteller. Anwar thought it was very funny and chose to use it for his film. But I think while making The Act of Killing, Hermann really fell in love with acting. And he developed an actor's loyalty to the truth, to the emotional and moral truth of any given situation. And that, like any good actor, has to have, and I think has to have that loyalty. And I think Hermann's an excellent actor. And Hermann plays this very important role throughout the film, kind of gently leading Anwar back to his pain, mm-hmm. When Anwar gets cold feet and starts to run away from the implications of what they're filming.
How often did you finish a day of shooting, or have your teams in other parts of the city finish a day of shooting and think, they have revealed so much to us about their activities that surely tomorrow we will not be welcome back?
Very rarely. That happened at the beginning, mm-hmm. Because at the beginning when I was filming, you know, this is not a matter of giving people enough rope to hang themselves by, in that everybody, all of the perpetrators I filmed up to when I met Anwar, were very, very open and would tell me exactly what they did the very first time I met them. And so by the time Anwar began this filmmaking process, it was clear he was not trying to look good. He was somehow trying to deal with his pain run away from it at the same time, in the sense that every reenactment, you know, every dramatization was another denial of the moral meaning of what they had done. You can't create a musical number or a cowboy scene about mass killing and not be in denial of the moral meaning of what you've done. And I think the film traces the evolution of that denial, traces the effects on the killers and on the whole society of that kind of self-deception, that was more the point than each reenactment somehow exposing greater detail about their crimes. As I said earlier, this is not a film about, you know, a historical film that forensically chronicles what they did. This is about how we as human beings tell stories to ourselves, to lie to ourselves, to justify our actions, and to escape from our most bitter and painful truths.
I mean, when you're making a film about those things, do you have to also examine the nature of filmmaking itself and ask about your own motivations and what you're doing?
Yeah, absolutely. And you have to ask some pretty complicated questions to which I'm not sure I have any conclusive answers, about what do we do? You know, killing is a quintessentially human act. It's painful to say. People can say, how can you humanize these men? Well, the answer to that is very simple. They are human, period. But filmmaking is also quintessentially human, and watching films is human. And what are we doing when we watch violent movies, for example? Why do we watch violent movies? I don't think that the message of the film is that sort of Hollywood violence led these men to be violent. No, they were killing people anyways. But the escapist entertainment of an Elvis Presley musical helped Anwar to distance himself from the act of killing. He says he would walk out of an Elvis Presley musical, dance his way across the street, and kill people happily. So acting, in a sense, or that he would get swept up in the movie, act like his screen idol, and thereby distance himself from what he was doing. So acting was always part of the act of killing. But then what does it mean to make a movie that is also entertaining? What does it mean to make a movie where the viewer is fascinated by beauty or fascinated by, you know, watching fictional or dramatic recreations of violence? So I think there's a lot, there's a whole series of questions about filmmaking that the film asks but may not conclusively answer.
Well, you talk about, you know, people asking questions about you humanizing these men. I wonder what it was like for you, not as a filmmaker, but just as a person. I don't believe we ever see you in the film, but you're sort of present off screen. And we know that you have formed a comfortable enough relationship to these men that, like, they call you Josh, and they seem very, very much at ease in speaking with you. I mean, was it strange to wake up and realize, you know, this one brought me a drink yesterday, or this is someone that I have, you know, I don't always find myself upset to be in his company. And how did you sort of process that as you got to know them as people?
I think that you know, sometimes I think I became less and less numb, not more and more numb to being with them. You know, people sometimes say, didn't you gradually become numb to all of this because you were hearing it again and again? But the closer I became to Anwar, the more I had to force myself at the beginning to see him as a human being, but as I came to know him as a human being, it became easier and easier. The more I saw him as a human being, the more I recognized that I cannot make an honest film about this person in all of his complexity unless I'm close to him. The more open and vulnerable I became to him and to the things he told me. And so as he would tell me these horrific stories about killing, it started to take a toll on me in the sense that it gave me, I started to develop pretty painful nightmares. That then led to pretty difficult insomnia, which went on for the better part of a year. And if I came through it, it was because of especially the support of my Indonesian crew, all of whom, at the end of the film, it's kind of the final statement of the film, all of whom are credited as anonymous to protect their safety.
What are the chances that this film will find a large audience in Indonesia? Will it be permitted to be exhibited?
The film has found a large audience in Indonesia. You see, Indonesia bans films dealing with human rights violations in Indonesia. And we knew that if we simply submitted the film to the censors, it would be banned. So what we did, and if they ban the film, we knew that then it becomes a crime to screen the film at all. And if it's a crime to screen the film, then the paramilitary groups in Indonesia or the army could physically attack screenings with impunity. So to avoid that, all last autumn we held screenings for Indonesia's National Human Rights Commission at Indonesia's National Human Rights Commission in Jakarta, for Indonesia's leading news publishers, news producers, journalists, historians, filmmakers, movie stars, educators, human rights advocates, survivors groups, artists, writers. Everybody was very, very moved by the film and said, we have to screen this film. But the media in particular said, look, there was a time before the act of killing. Now there's a time after the act of killing. We have to break our silence about what happened in 1965. There's no stuffing this genie back in the bottle. There's no pretending this didn't happen. And so on the 1st of October last year, the largest media, news magazine in Indonesia, Tempo Magazine, published a special double edition about the 1965-66 genocide and about the film. And this was their way of breaking their decades-long silence on the genocide. They published 75 pages of boastful testimony from killers all over the country and 25 pages about the movie in order to show that the act of killing is a repeatable experiment, that these problems exposed by the film are systemic. And the rest of the media then followed suit and published their own and produced their own pieces about the genocide. And then on the 10th of December last year, International Human Rights Day, all the people who'd seen the film in the autumn took the film back to their communities and held screenings. This began with 50 screenings in 30 cities, averaging in size of around 200 people. That then had grew as of April. We were at 500 screenings in 95 cities, and then we lost count. But every week there's more screenings than there were the previous week. As someone from the National Human Rights Commission has said, perpetrators in Indonesia no longer boast about what they've done, which is not such an important improvement on its own, but it's a sign that the national discourse about the killings has gone through a sea change since the film has come to Indonesia.
There is no soundtrack, no music track in the film, and I wonder if you experimented with music and then decided that silence was more effective, or how that decision was made.
I think that it felt that, to me, that this is a film about cinema and about how we, our emotions are manipulated through storytelling and how we manipulate our own emotions through storytelling. And there's really nothing more manipulative emotionally. It can be very effective and can be worth having. I'm not opposed to scores, to film scores, to music tracks. But there's nothing more manipulative to our emotions when we watch films than music. And it felt like this material is so powerful, it must speak for itself. And there should be an immersive, and also there should be an immersive relationship to the material. We should be immersed in these men's world. And that's also, in fact, why there's no survivors and why there's no commentary track, because there's nothing in the film, there's no external point of view, apart from the distance and the language of the sort of film language of each scene. There's no narrator, commentator, storyteller who's sort of from a distance telling you or indicating for you how you should relate to this material.
Do you feel like a different person than you were before you started this project?
Yeah, most certainly. This film it was a 7.5-year process shooting this film, and there were 2 years of working with survivors and perpetrators before that. This film has made me, making this film and going through this journey with Anwar and with my Indonesian crew has made me who I am. And in fact, when Anwar saw the finished film, he was, of course, devastated in a way, but he was also very moved. He sat in silence for a long time. He was tearful. And he said, "Josh, this film shows what it is like to be me. This is an honest film. I'm glad I was able to be so honest." And, you know, he has, ever since he saw it on the 1st of November last year, remained proud of his film. He's only said positive things about it since he saw it. Before that, he'd been asked by the force to come to, not forced, but called to a paramilitary press conference where, of course, flanked by two powerful paramilitary leaders, he said perhaps the film isn't what he was expecting. But he had not seen the film yet, and, of course, he had to say that in that moment. But since he's seen it, he has been proud is the wrong word, but and glad and happy, these are all the wrong words, but he has remained loyal to the film. And he and I remain in touch.
I'm so sorry that we're out of time. I would love to continue the conversation. The new documentary by Joshua Oppenheimer is called The Act of Killing. It opens at the Angelica Film Centers in Plano in Dallas tomorrow. Joshua, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy, with the podcast produced by Christine McConnell, Christina Martinez on the phones, Lindsay Connect as assistant producer, and Jeff Whittington as executive producer. I am Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.